Good morning. Parts of speech. Some stories don't want to be told. They walk away, carrying their suitcases held together with grey string. Look at their disappearing curved spines, hunchbacks, harmed ones, holdalls. Some stories refuse to be danced or mimed, drop their scuffed canes and clattering tap shoes, erase their traces in nursery rhymes or ancient games like blind man's buff. And at this stained place, words are scraped from resinous tongues, wrung like washing, hung on the lines of courtroom and confessional, transposed into the dialect of record. Why still believe stories can rise with wings on currents as silver flares, levitate unweighted by stones, begin in pain and move towards grace, aerating history with recovered breath? Why still imagine whole words, whole worlds, the flame splutter of consonants, deep sea anemone vowels, birth cable syntax, rhymes that start in the heart, and verbs, verbs that move mountains? Thank you, Ben, for inviting me to participate in this project and for the chance to respond to its unusual and carefully crafted set of related themes. I sort of half welcome the opportunity to think about the poetic process. Occasionally it was a full welcome, but occasionally it was a half welcome, because I have some internal warning bells about doing this, and I'm sure you understand them. They relate, of course, to an implication of your project. The dynamic that usually holds, as far as I understand it, is that critics and academics write about the work of writers, and then writers complain about critics and theorists. So I come to your workshop as a writer and not as a critic or theorist. I can't even busk about theory. A persistent requirement of the academy, however, and also the media, as I understand it, is to require of creative artists not only that they should compose their poems, novels, or paint, or draw, or make music. Am I reverberating? He did tell me the word I had to test this was bomb, which I thought was a bit unfortunate. So we're asked somehow to do our work, but then also deploy the language of the media or the academy to explain or reflect on what we've already done. Recompose the work again, as it were, inside another language, the secondary version often given much more attention than the primary one. I know that the contributors to this workshop, who include so many well-known poets and other writers, know about these contradictions. And I particularly noted, it's either Jared or Ben's comment, the signalling of the dangers of assuming that literary technique, quote, is the artful exploration of a critical thinking whose medium is properly conceptual and to which criticism restores it. But even a benign academic environment like yours begs the question of whether poets should reflect or write publicly about their own processes, except in the most allusive and elusive ways, which I think is sort of what Michael did. I say this not to be churlish or defensive, but to suggest that what I have to say about my own practice can't really be trusted. It's only provisional, it's close to a guess, closer to subterfuge, and possibly closer still to a lie. And I hope to avoid the danger of drowning in an endless refracting mirror, a female narcissist. My hope is I can make a little headway if I try and answer a question for myself. Why and how did I come to write about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa? Though I imagine that the same question and conditional answer might apply to my writing about any subject, including HIV/AIDS, xenophobia, mining, love, apartheid, mourning, relational bonds, aging, all themes that I've responded to over my career. I don't see my engagement with the TRC as separate from my other poetic engagements, but it does possibly the focus the questions you pose and may serve as an entrance to the poems I've written in the glaring sun of South African realities, even when seeking shade from it. I'm going to therefore approach your critical question by talking about aspects of my own writing process. A process, as everyone knows, more unconscious than conscious, though disciplined by the reading of many poems, a fairly long career, and by personal life and social conditions. I speak as a poet working among other writers in a particular environment at a particular time with readers from different backgrounds and cultures, and indeed some from different countries. Now, the South African poetry community is fairly diverse, and I've understood after I've been here for 1 week that that's so for Australia too, and represented by a relatively wide range of creative paths. And as in many other places in the world, readership of written poetry is small, very small. There are few journals, probably only 3 or 4 in the whole country, and other publishing possibilities are small, but there is a well-attended public poetry reading culture. In other words, people listen, they don't buy. In order to indicate, however, superficially something of this community and the various poetic identities, I'm going to mention 3 figures whom I consider significant. I hope it doesn't just feel like a kind of 101 South African poetry introduction. But in a way, I think they complicate the topic that was set in the workshop. So it's not really to distinguish my concerns and choices from theirs, as to suggest possibly that settler and native can produce rather unexpected imaginative responses to the burden of language and historical pressure in South Africa. Lesego Rampolaking is a black poet who some of you might know. He's mainly, but not only, a performance poet, and he's very committed to inventive hybrid forms that confront, even assault, the nature of power. He insists on his work and his own non-complicity with authority and its forms of manipulation. His register, interestingly, has remained unchanged from his early, very powerful attacks on the apartheid regime and on the control of a particular kind of English. I personally think there's some misogynist turns in his work, but I admire his disruptive articulations greatly. I could not write that way, even if I wanted to. My class, my race, my experiences, my suspicion of Vatic pronouncement, and my belief that my own language works best in a more restrained form, but with directed purpose, would make it impossible. And no doubt, if I did speak into the national and international sound bank that way, it would inevitably lead to interpretations of deep conservative politics, whereas Rampolaking is assured of legitimate radical credentials, no matter what his critique of the new government and its forces. In that sense, white, of course, always determines reception in South Africa, though a whole host of other factors are also in play. On the other end of the spectrum is a poet like the late Stephen Watson, a white poet, whose work is produced not by obvious polemical positionings, but by high culture contemplative positions and a direct claim to significant poetic antecedents from Larkin to Milosh, and actually it includes Leonard Cohen. His is a curious legacy. In some ways, he's representative of those who feel that their access to social commentary has been stripped from them, given their class and colour and colonial antecedents, and whose attachment to the land consequently needs constant reassertion. He's demonstrably a claimant to international themes and European poetic influences, and in a positive reading, these identifications broaden what are often narrowly self-referential South African considerations. We're inclined in South Africa to see ourselves as exceptional, as our history is exceptional, as our contributions is exceptional, as some in some way as separate from a body of thinking about politics and about writing in the rest of the world. So there's both that yearning for recognition and a kind of disapproval of outside commentary and of reading. Some of this has to do with the remnants of the cultural boycott, I think. What Watson does is he calls into his constellation a lot of significant political poets from elsewhere in the world, especially Europe, without engaging with their particularities, but seeing them as kind of ethical avatars. He's very interested in local landscape, usually emptied of people, especially the Cederberg, which is a set of beautiful mountains in the Cape. And I call that work his Cederberg sublime. The San, the Bushman, whose voices he feels special access to and wishes to return metaphorically to the poetic and national domain. And melancholy, claimed not only as a personal condition, but as a cultural aptitude. These all feature significantly in his work. Since his untimely death recently, his role as a poet and cultural commentator is receiving increasing attention. And this may or may not shift the discussions about South African poetry, because previously he's been figured at one end, even as an end of a tradition, a position also assigned to Guy Butler, a not entirely dissimilar figure, although I'm revisiting my views of Butler, having heard Jared yesterday, and Butler was a man that Stephen Watson much admired and defended. The third poet I want to comment on, his name is Jeremy Cronin. He's a deputy chair of the Communist Party, and he occupies a seat in the Jacob Zuma cabinet. He is an interesting figure because he's a very committed figure, a white figure. And so he unsettles predictable expectations about how South African poets, whether from settler traditions or black indigenous traditions, might be expected to approach the business of crafting or assembling poetry and its relation to the crafting or dissembling of a community. Cronin's role has meant that he hasn't written a lot recently, but his collections and influence is extremely significant, not just on poetry, but on South African literature as a whole. He writes from inside a set of juxtaposed perspectives, which include an overt recognition of settler roots, a wry critique of Heaney, who apparently, in Jeremy's account, apparently stable cultural assumptions about Homer, Spencer, and Yeats, and themes related directly to his political activism, incarceration, exile, return, and renewed Communist Party and ANC involvement. He can write the gentlest of love poems and then a humorous version of the same, wittily construct a Jeremiad, dramatize moments of shared commitment in prison, call lyrically for South Africans to, quote, learn to speak with the languages of the land in order to animate national resolve, rebuke capital, demystify Mandela, and meditate in the poem Moorage on the way love and social solidarity function as anchorage, by invoking the human and natural history of a small town called Churchhaven in the Western Cape. It seems to me that Cronin's evocation of the need for personal and political moorings is key to his poetic purpose, but without the shadows of colonial or racial guilt and anxiety, or the appropriations of a certain type of settler consciousness might be prey to. I mention these three poets, two white, one black, to suggest something of the range of responses and practices, and also, again, to suggest that the term settler poet might not accommodate enough of the fractures inside the community itself, but also the writers and poets in South Africa, though it does assist in defining some elements that pressure the imagination. There are many other poets writing in English. I'm not going to give you a much longer list than three or four, but for anyone who's interested, there's a very interesting woman poet, Karen Press, who's multilingual, very influenced by Russian poets. There's Yvette Christiansa, who's a South African who lived in Australia for many years and who now teaches in New York, who's written a volume called Castaway, a really extraordinary rendition of settler, colonial, and slavery themes. Rustam Kozane, writing lyrical and narrative poetry, very influenced by Derek Walcott, and now increasingly by Afrikaans. And then there are people like Kelvin Soul, Joan Metlekamp, Habiba Badarun, and the Afrikaans poets, about whom I'm going to say very little. I'm speaking about English. But the Afrikaans poets, chief amongst them are Ankie Krog, who I think is the greatest risk taker of everyone. I think for most of us, to a lesser or greater degree, the poetic imperative includes the issue of how to find a home but not a solipsistic refuge inside the languages and images of identity and difference delivered to us. How to poetically respect difference without becoming a casualty of it. How to resist amnesia. How to generate and respond to reciprocities without dissolving into Rainbow Nation cant. How to make language responsive and responsible in an environment that still is highly suspicious of language, whether it's social, legal, or political definitional language, political rhetoric, and creative writing. They're all still subject to public vigilance. This is because, of course, of the way language was used in particular by the apartheid regime, the mislabeling of forms of activity. It's never easy or reliable to speak of one's own creative path. I try in my poems themselves to make present my struggle with words. I feel that the dramas of public life, entrenched difference and reductive official history can be re-encountered and recomposed through the intimate, the smaller gesture, and that individual pain can be glimpsed inside the apparently impenetrable large public events and forces. Precise and patterned language, carefully calibrated questions, the unsettling of form inside the respect for its directives. These things matter to me as they do to many other poets. And to respect, but implicate the reader as much as myself in the private material as well as the public record. The task, as I see it for my own practice, is how to produce flexible and generative, not closed or programmatic poetic positions or forms, while still holding faith, unfashionably, with the idea of poetic authority. I think all of you will know something of what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission attempted. Its public hearings and other processes, the reconstruction of the past that it foregrounded, its documentation of apartheid human rights violations, its recommendations for amnesty and reparations, and where commentators judged it failed. I'm not going to repeat an account of its practices and failures and successes here, and my own account in some ways in the poems. But one thing interesting to me, and perhaps to you too, is how few poems have been written about the TRC, about the testimony, or about the process. There have been other creative works, Anki Kroch's well-known book, Country of My Skull, a few novels, including one by Gillian Slovo, Ubu and the Truth Commission, the Kentridge Handspring puppet collaboration written by Jane Taylor, some films, some paintings, but to my knowledge, very few poems. I can only speculate about why this might be the case, apart from the generic difficulty of dealing with sort of material. I think anxiety about the nature of representation of traumatic material, fear of contributing uncritically to the notion of a fair political settlement, awareness of the dangers of appropriation, desire to respect the pressures of justice or revenge. It's not possible to tell, but having attempted to write about it, I do understand what a risky business it can be. The poems I'll comment on are only a selection of those I wrote about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. South Africans always do this with words about, because if you were called coloured or black or white and you wish to resist that set of definitions, you would go, I am a coloured person. I am a white person. In other words, this is not my language, this is language someone else has used about me. So I'm inclined to want to lift my hands up quite often. These poems constitute a group that, in retrospect really only, seem to deal with the nature of language itself, the position of the poet in relation to that language, and the unstable and disjunctive processes of memory and the pressure of history. In the process, I had to question and resist or reconfigure in new terms the alluring ambition of lyric, especially elegy, in its attempt to transcend and redeem experience, obviously an impossible task. But I confess too that that was a difficulty for me to take that subject on. When composing the sequence, I was acutely aware of the dense, unsettled relationship between compositional and ethical issues in the economy of what I'll call decorum and risk involved in writing on a subject such as the TRC. It seemed to me then, as it seems to me now, that one had only two choices in the face of such an important public event, either to write about it or not to write about it. Not to write about it would, of course, could, of course, derive from a range of factors, honourable or otherwise. Personally, I could not choose that. It seemed grotesque. But choosing to write about the material raised an equally dark set of spectres. Everything depended on how one wrote and what position one took inside the space and the language and forms which reenacted or rememoried the process. I had no special access to the TRC. I attended quite a few hearings. I listened to the radio broadcast and watched TV obsessively during the time. I listened to tapes afterwards. I personally knew people who gave evidence. I was not a victim or survivor. I was not a perpetrator. But I was, in a general way, am still, however unwilling, whatever my politics or personal history, a beneficiary of the historic conditions which made the TRC necessary. White, middle class, with access to schools and universities, to relatively safe neighborhoods, freedom of movement, and facilities others were excluded from. This is my, in your term, inherited complicity. The term settler poet, which your workshop uses to define one aspect of that complicity, is one I don't really personally recognize as a determining factor as a poet or a citizen. Strong rallying calls and cries against settlers were first used in the Pan-African Congress in South Africa in 1959 for whites to be driven into the sea for an Africa for Africans. But since the end of apartheid, oddly, the settler appellation seems to have suffered some attrition. The cry of the populist movement led by Julius Malema, whom some of you may know about, he used to call one settler, one bullet, and sing songs with that incarnated in it, and the other, kill the Boer, seems to have diminished temporarily at least, though I don't for a minute suggest that demands for nationalization of the mines or radical redistribution of land do not have a similar rhetorical source, carry a similar recognition of and hostility to the powerful remnants of white colonial and apartheid power. It's a truism that economic power is still held by the minority white community, but also necessary to remember that control is increasingly exercised by a growing black elite and an international cabal of foreign governments and big corporations which own to no settler status. And we all know here that imperial control, colonial invasion, suppression of languages, settler appropriations are not unique to South Africa, Australia and Canada. And whatever their temporal and spatial differences, it's been happening for a very long time. We can think of just the Greeks, the Arabs of the Mediterranean, and even of two poets, Cavafy and Neruda, and their interactions with the idea of settler writing and the meaning, for instance, of Spanish. This is not to dislodge the usefulness of the term settler, that it might have a point of access to material, but it suggests that its limits are just as interesting. I realized when I was writing this that I think about settlers in two ways, and I think it either suggests a suppression on my part or repression on my part, or something about the changing nature of my country. And that is obvious. Most obviously, I think of settlers as, you know, groups of people who leave their own lands as part of a conquering colonial power, sponsored to get to a place, takeover, the ways we all know. The other way I think about it is the less organized aggregate of migrants or refugees who arrive with few support systems, unsponsored by the state, also in search of a better life, and who are perceived as a disruptive threat to the nation or people's economic and cultural autonomy. To be a little clearer, perhaps a little braver, what I mean is this. I am part of a minority racial group, a minority to which I only partly relate, though many, including me, have settler origins. In a majority-run democratic country to which I also only partly relate. Nobody in South Africa is writing anymore inside a white-dominated society. That is the great consequence of the democratic change. even though the structures and vestiges may sometimes suggest that little has changed. I am a citizen now, perhaps a more complex position to be in than a settler. That's one version of my position. The other is that I'm a poet, and that these things only relate in asymmetrical ways. To write the TRC poems, I had to implicitly recommit to poetry as the language of complication and become a transcriber, a sound engineer, with all the dangers and technical improvisations that implies. Everyone here knows the gestation of a poem is mysterious, it's resistant to crude analysis. My tools were, as always, parts of speech, syntax and grammar, the engineering of sound in the air, typography of words on the page. I only understood the meaning of some of the choices I made somewhat later. For example, I realized later, and I really can't say if I realized this or if some critic told me that's what I should have realized, that in addition to the half-partial rhymes that I tend to use a lot, I used a lot more end rhyme. And I think there was somewhere in the work a need for a more formal frame to control such difficult material. There may be other reasons, of course. My subject itself was also those very words and sounds, as well as the reader, the listener, who hears, speaks, writes, turns towards or away from words. And despite the nature of the TRC and its testimonies, which placed a special burden on one's ordinary compositional archive, with the dangers of appropriation and false witness all around one, the choice of where to place a comma, what length a line should be, what stanzaic choice to make, what title to give a poem, when to use metaphorical language and when not, continued to be determined not only by the internal demands of an actual poem, but by one's whole history of placing commas, question marks, and titles. So it was in the writing of these poems. The sequence I wrote was originally entitled A Room Full of Questions and is framed by two poems, the one I just read called Parts of Speech and a final one entitled Body Parts. They're all on the sheet. A critic has called attention to the way these poems frame the cycle, one about fragmented discourse and the other about the fragments of the body. It articulates my sense of what I was doing at the time of finalizing the titles and shaping the cycle. The damage done by apartheid to the physical and communal body, the relation of language and speech to the body, that is what absorbed me when putting the sequence together. I was particularly drawn to topics on the edge of the TRC, not in the frontline positions, not in the lurid or sensational parts of the testimony, but in releasing some possible meanings of figures such as the transcriber, the sound engineer, the general, the perpetrator, and of subjects such as the naming of the forgotten, the nature of forgiveness, and the ineluctable failure of language to capture experiences of violation and survival. My TRC poems explore what was done to the autonomy of people, to all of us, to white and black by whites. And in other poems, for instance, poems about HIV and xenophobia by blacks. Because they are blacks does not put the subject out of my poetic consideration or strangle my poetic inquiry. The question for me is always, how am I, how are we implicated in the situation? And how can poetic language engage with that question of implication? So I've taken your invitation to discuss specific instances of craft seriously, but it'll be brief. The poem I read first, Parts of Speech, is concerned, obviously, with the prospect that a poet must, or so it seems to me, simultaneously be wary of writing stories which don't want to be told, of invading privacies of pain, of contributing to a questionable public record, and at the same time has to be committed to that responsibility, a commitment doomed to failure. Because to write at all means one believes in the power of language, however problematic, however diminished, it being all we have. Most writers cannot avoid believing implicitly that stories can rise above the mere recording of detail, can levitate into another element, and can even aerate history. That is poetry's power and its necessary delusion. The poem's fulcrum is in the third stanza, which offers a version of what happened to words in the TRC, a form of domestic damage to language and to the people who gave accounts. Words scraped, wrung, hung, transposed. Domestic imagery always somehow, I use a lot of it, transfers into other meanings. That sort of language presents itself to me. It was always also very present in TRC testimony by women. Hence, rung like washing, hung on the lines of courtroom and confessional. It was interesting, the rung word that appeared in the Butler poem too. Clearly the connections with torture, as with hung, reverberate, but weren't particularly consciously in my mind. The counterforce in the poem is the lingering, vulnerable faith posed as a set of questions that poet stories can rise using the traditional resources of poetry, words and their parts, consonants and vowels and rhymes from a deep internal but shared source. Unconsciously at the beginning, but more consciously during the editing, my poems are usually subjected to more than 20 edits, I was aware of the pressure of internal rhymes reinforcing or destabilizing the subject, of run-on lines, of the balance of equal line stanzas offering ballast to an unequal argument, and of the mad claim of the last line, though qualified by its status as a question. And to read a poem called The Archbishop Chairs the First Session. On the first day, after a few hours of testimony, the Archbishop wept. He put his grey head on the long table of papers and protocols, and he wept. The national and international cameramen filmed his weeping, his misted glasses, his sobbing shoulders, the call for a recess. It doesn't matter what you thought of the Archbishop before or after, of the settlement, the commission, or what the anthropologists flying in from less studied crimes and sorrows said about the discourse, or how many doctorates, books, and installations followed, or even if you think this poem simplifies, lionizes, romanticizes, mystifies. There was a long table, starched purple vestment, and after a few hours of testimony, the Archbishop, chair of the commission, laid down his head and wept. That's how it began. This was an iconic moment in April 1996 when the TRC hearings opened and then closed for the day just a few hours later. For most South Africans watching this on television, it was striking and painful herald of what was to come hour by hour, day by day. The simple tableau, with its not-so-simple accoutrement, the religious, the semi-legal, the confessional, the televised mechanical apparatus, seemed to me to speak, despite the hype, from inside its own life, with its own genuine force, despite foreign commentators advancing their media or academic careers, despite me advancing my poetic one. The poem is a simple reconstruction, I think, the image of the Archbishop appalled by the expression of things he already knew, about which most South Africans already knew, though not in detail. His response seemed to me to have the power to quieten, however temporarily, those critical of the TRC and the political settlement of which it was a part. The poem chooses to anticipate the critique that might be engendered by it. My instinct must have been, how can I tell for sure, that prose-like constructions were necessary, paired of figurative language and using apparently direct reporting, and a sequence of semi-combative statements framing questions as a form of risky head-on resistance. There's a significant change of word order at the end and a one-line stanza. But of course the poem has to be aware that this opening moment was itself a metaphoric instance, a dramatic spectacle which demanded, invited recognition and recomposition as crafted poetic drama. The TRC, which depended on words and testimony for its legitimation and meaning, began like this, outside words, outside rhetoric, but inside gesture. The Archbishop's loss of control seemed to me a strong and moving encounter with rigid historical conditions of apartheid. Words, the first words of testimony, could not be born. The rest of the TRC would be about the way the language of evidence related to the language of experience and feeling, trying to turn both into the language of record. It attempted to wrest control over the material, but occasionally returned in a form of suspension to moments of individual collapse when witnesses were unable to continue speaking or material became verbally incoherent or opaque. The TRC ended with a long written report, a long conclusion, but never a conclusion carrying the same power as the testimony, the call for a recess on the first day. I'm going to read a poem called The Transcriber Speaks. Since there was quite a lot of conversation about transcription yesterday, I thought it might be interesting. I was the commission's own captive, its anonymous after-hours scribe, professional blank slate. Word by word by word, from winding tape to hieroglyphic key, from sign to sign, I listened and wrote. Like bricks for a kiln, or tiles for a roof, or the sweeping of leaves into piles for burning, I don't know which, word upon word upon word. At first unpunctuated, apart from quotations and full stops, but how to transcribe silence from tape? Is weeping a pause or a word? What written sign for a strangled throat? And a witness pointing? That I described when officials identified direction and name. But what if she stared? And if the silence seemed to stretch past the police guard, into the street, away to a door, or a grave, or a child? Was it my job to conclude the witness was silent? There was nothing left to say. It took me a very long time reading this often to realize that I was writing about the difficulty of writing. I know that's stupid of me, but there you are. I really thought I was writing about the transcriber for quite a long time. Positioned as they were in front of the hearings, such an important word, transcribers had to produce an account the record. We know the transcribers sometimes skipped recording the details of evidence they could not understand or hear properly. Sometimes they didn't record repetitions or lost focus. And like translators, it unintentionally mistranslated material because of cultural and linguistic chasms. Anki Kroc's co-authored book, There Was This Goat, sheds light on this gulf by revisiting some puzzling misinterpreted testimony of one of the witnesses, the TRC, to restore her autonomy as a person in travail as well as the meaning of her testimony. A very interesting book if anyone wants to get hold of it. I was not conscious of constructing a sequence so dependent on questions, which, as all poets know, can affect the rhythm of lines, leave readers feeling anxious and trapped, sometimes even manipulated, as the poetic voice refuses the comfort of a closed sentence. But that was the effect I implicitly wished for. Neither the transcriber nor the poet know exactly what the job entails, but they know they're not able to perform it adequately. Meaning slides away, though they build an edifice from tiles, from bricks, from words. The structure is unstable, and both are equivocal about the role they play in reporting on the pain of others. The poem acknowledges the obvious, that words are limited. And all those bodily expressions, a closed-up throat, pointing, weeping, and especially silence. The speaker knows that there is no language for the unsayable, but goes on saying so. I'm not going to read The Sound Engineer. I think I'm running out of time, but it's on your list of that little handout. And this poem, just to give some reference to it, the sound engineers at the TRC did what sound engineers do. They had to fragment, shorten, and then recompose material, make it clearer, stronger, coherent, edit what they had already heard over and over again for other listeners, other ears. In the process, many collapsed under the stress of what they heard. So this poem, I think, is about many things, but also about the act of editing. Editing for effect, which is what poets do too. Listening to accounts of intense pain and humiliation that then reduces the body to just one instrument, one body part, the ear. And a critic has written about the poem that the imperfect mechanics of the editing and recording machines find a human version in the imperfect receptors of sounds and words and meanings in the voice box, the eardrum, the brain, and the tongue. I'm going to read a final poem. It is the poem that finished the sequence. And it's called Body Parts. May the wrist turn in the wind like a wing, the severed foot tread home ground, the punctured ear hear the thrum of sunbirds, the molten eye see stars in the dark, the faltering lungs quicken windmills, the maimed hand scatter seeds and grain, the heart flood underground springs, pound maize, recognize named cattle, and may the unfixable broken bone loosened from its hinges, now lying like a wishbone in the felt, pitted by pointillist ants, give us new bearings. The poem completed the cycle. The other poems include some other topics dealing with evidence more directly, some with perpetrators, and some, like the poem Some There Be, raising the question of whether those who have been forgotten can be brought back to life through naming, through words, the Lazarus fantasy of writers everywhere. Body Parts, constructed in mainly two-line stanzas, is self-evidently in the form of a prayer, but its comforts, I imagine, are spare. The first word is may, and the broken bone is unfixable. You will note the us that appears at the end. This is my unapologetic citizen us. All of us harmed, though in different ways. All broken into parts, individual and social capacities distorted. The wrist, the ear, the eye, the lungs, the heart, the bone, tortured, broken, and dispersed. They are envisaged as separate, and even in the prayer do not get reconstituted into the solution of a single body or community. That would seem sacrilegious somehow. Instead, the anatomical parts stay suspended, dismembered, not as surreal imaginative exercises, but possibly able to speak into the uncertain future from the broken past, cautiously hopeful, giving new bearings. In a fractured world, there can be no simple reconstitutive elegy. This is still the work of mourning. Thank you.